Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us now to discuss what has been an action-packed week for the relationship between China and the United States are Dr. Patrick Cronin, who heads the Asia-Pacific Studies at the Hudson Institute Think Tank, and Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute. Guys, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our broader cyber coverage. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. Elbit sponsors our trade show coverage. And Bell, of course, sponsors this podcast. Patrick, let's start with you. It's been an extraordinarily busy week on China. Obviously, the White House dropped a 16-page report today that in large part reiterates what their attitude and posture toward China has been. Beijing has moved to restrict freedoms in Hong Kong weeks after arresting leaders of the city's democratic movement, among them Figo Chan, who we interviewed last year, along with Emily Lau, as they accepted the Halifax International Security Forum's annual McCain Prize for leadership. Bipartisan lawmakers have called on sanctions against any entity or individual that enforces that new law from Beijing. Is the international community going to come to Hong Kong's rescue? What happens if it doesn't? And if so, what's the right way for everybody to act on this issue?
So first of all, the competition with China, not just between the United States and China, but I think the region and the world and China, is continuing to escalate and grow. Hong Kong is a very important issue, but it is just one issue. This week, obviously, you have Beijing essentially reneging on their 1990s promise of the basic agreement that would grant Hong Kong autonomy through the middle of this century. Instead, imposing by fiat these crackdowns essentially on the freedoms and the democratic protests that were simmering through last year, but got quieted by the pandemic. And now China's roaring back and not waiting for Carrie Lam, the chief legislative officer in Hong Kong, to do their bidding, but rather they're by fiat imposing a new national security law on the canard that there's foreign interference that's creating instability in Hong Kong. That's just not the case. This is a domestic uprising for freedom and for keeping Beijing to the autonomy commitment that they made in the 1990s. Now, this is all happening at the same time that China's major political consultative people's conference has opened up. In fact, most startling thing there is the picture of it opening up, because we don't see many mass gatherings anywhere around the world these days. And this is something that ordinarily would be a rubber stamp for Xi Jinping. But in this case, the timing is extremely crucial for him to demonstrate this wounded emperor, if you will, that the economic freefall of China is not to be worried about. I mean, for instance, the debt to GDP in China just surpassed 300% this quarter, and that the political questions being asked about Xi's handling of the pandemic and his leadership, including tensions with the United States, are not to be questioned. He wants to show unity. He wants to demonstrate that China is going to get its economic act together. And Hong Kong is, I believe, collateral damage. It is basically the easiest way to exercise nationalistic symbolism from the Chinese Communist Party without, as you say, triggering a rescue from the international community, because there's very little the international community can do immediately to respond to essentially a legal crackdown, a political crackdown. They can obviously help shine a spotlight on the problem. They can over time put economic pressures on China, but there's no specific response that you can't rescue, you know, Hong Kong. But we can start giving them a voice, and I think you'll hear a lot of Hong Kong voices around the world and in the United States talk about this. This also coincides, obviously, with the White House now interestingly dropping this new document, which is the clearest, most coherent, most comprehensive take on the administration's U.S.-China strategy. And this is not something that's normally done, as you know, Vago. We don't usually see this kind of document suddenly dropped. But here it is, very clearly articulating two broad objectives about needing to make our institutions and alliances more resilient as the PRC challenges them. And we need to obviously reduce the harm that China is causing. And it goes through enumeration of a lot of different tools in the toolkit that we are using to beat back economic espionage, political warfare, propaganda, espionage on S&T, cyber attacks, and so on. But there's nothing really new in it. I mean, it's a compilation of everything that anybody who follows this closely is aware of. But it is impressive when you see it all in one place, and now it's on the White House webpage.
It is great, and in many respects, right, I mean, this is sort of the duality of this administration's approach to China. On many counts, it's right on the mark. The trouble is that the president himself doesn't really fully believe in this, right? Congress had to force the president to back Hong Kong human rights demonstrators last year at a time when the president didn't want to do anything that would upset the prospects for the trade deal. I want to get to the broader relationship in a moment, but first want to go to Mackenzie. Mackenzie, you spend a lot of time talking to lawmakers on a bipartisan basis on this issue, and there are a lot of lawmakers. I mean, there has been a very, very strong bipartisan reaction, as I mentioned, from prominent members, Chris Van Hollen, as well as folks on the Republican side, have put this statement out. But the concern is that some of the lawmakers that were the most forceful voices for Democratic action, Lindsey Graham being one of them, have been somewhat more muted in these terms, in part because they're concerned about how the president is going to respond to statements that they make. How do you see Congress's, right, there's bipartisan agreement on China, but is there bipartisan agreement on how to respond to China in moments like this?
Unfortunately, I see increasingly most issues getting wrapped up already in presidential year election politics. And it's unfortunate because foreign policy, you would think it would be more immune than domestic issues. But in presidential years, I'm seeing that more. So Congress has also, they've seen a trend with this president. So recently they tried to override the president's veto, for example, of the bill restricting his unilateral ability to strike Iran, and they don't have the votes. So, you know, it was a great initiative that they took, but, you know, I think members look at these issues and say there's only so much bandwidth, particularly in this sort of remote work environment experience and proxy voting and all of that. And so why take on those issues when we can't even agree if we're going to have a fourth stimulus bill, you know, potentially to economic stimulus for coronavirus. And that's the trend line. And so less is getting done. And I think that continues each week until November. And it's not because of COVID. It's because of bigger issues. And it has the potential to risk the fraying of what. So I'm hoping I'm wrong, but I don't know how strong the bipartisan consensus is on China. To your point on what to do about it, the answers really start to go in every direction. I agree with Patrick. I read the document this morning as well at the White House website about China. It's a good list, and it's about time that it was put in one place, because the question I keep having, and this is when the Defense Strategy Commission had a year and a half ago, was who's in charge of coordinating not just across the federal government, but the feds with the private sector, with, you know, Silicon Valley and academia and et cetera. And it has to presumably be the White House and the NSC. And but this is the first time we're actually seeing that happen. So I'm curious to see the members' reactions to that document more so than I am to see if Congress is going to, you know, take some symbolic vote that they know may or may not change the president's mind on Hong Kong.
Patrick, to the broader relationship, right? I mean, there's an overwhelming sense that we're entering sort of a new Cold War, different from the old Cold War, but effectively China and authoritarian states on one side, democracies, however fractured they are now, on the other side, a whole bunch of realpolitik states in the middle that sort of slide between and among orbits as they find necessary. There is a major drive, hey, let's repudiate sources of manufacture from China. Let's try to hold China to account for intellectual property theft. So the dynamic in some respects is changing on China. And as you mentioned, Xi is in front of the body as the guy who got a lifetime term from the Council of Elders to take back Taiwan, you know, enforce discipline in Hong Kong, and then, you know, really stand up to the United States. And on all those fronts, he's been somewhat wounded. At this point, what does this competition look like? And at what point does China conclude, seeing as how that, you know, exports are only about 18%, you know, that its export or import market is about 18%. It's basically satisfying most of its own needs, that it decides, hey, you know what? Now's the time for me to rip off the Band-Aid, take back Taiwan, enforce discipline in Hong Kong, force the international community to heal, and that way I reset the tables and I assert myself as the hegemon in the region, which is what the strategy is anyway.
Well, again, I see this document out of the White House as part of an effort by people like Matthew Pottinger, now the Deputy National Security Advisor, trying to regain control over the China strategy, because I think he feels they've created a coherent Chinese strategy for competing, but not for containing and decoupling. Indeed, in this document, it reiterates the fact that the administration is not trying to contain China and it's not trying to disengage from the Chinese people. Those are carefully chosen words, but those are words that need to be sold to allies and partners. And in this document, it's very instructive that allies and partners are mentioned on 10 of the 16 pages. So it's repeating something that I think critics of the administration and supporters of the administration both would like to see more of, which is bringing along our allies and partners with a common game plan, whether it's dealing with 5G or dealing with now the nuclear threats that are coming from China as they expand and threaten to expand their nuclear arsenal or their cyber warfare and so on. And I think that is the challenge the administration has. It's not just having a coherent strategy in the White House, it's selling the country and and our allies and partners on it. I wrote in the Hill newspaper this week that we're still searching for a consensus in the United States, and that in many ways, I think what Mackenzie was saying was spot on, which is we've already become increasingly polarized, if that's possible, in our American polity because of this election year, to make China the litmus test. And either you are all against China or you're, you know, appeasing China, and there's no middle ground. But in fact, the administration says, yes, there has to be a sensible way forward. The administration's actually saying sensible things, but you're not hearing those sensible things because you've got people who are ahead of the administration saying, no, this means we're, you know, at war with, it's a new Cold War, it's even a hot war potentially with China. And that's overselling what even the administration's trying to do, which I think could be sold if indeed it were consistently marketed to Congress, the people in the country, and to allies and partners. You mentioned Taiwan. I think we have to say this is very important, because the reason Hong Kong is being picked on in part is because Taiwan is even a harder nut to crack for Beijing. So President Tsai Ing-wen just marked her second inauguration this week. It's a victory lap in many ways for her because of her democratic re-election in January, despite the pressure strategy from Beijing. Beijing has criticized the White House for congratulating President Tsai on her inauguration. But there are some people pushing for us to recognize, that is to switch diplomatic recognition back to the ROC, to Taiwan, which would be a non-starter. It would be the tail wagging the dog. You can't have us stepping across that red line. We don't need to do it. And President Tsai is not asking for it either. Instead, we need to help defend Taiwan economically through security and political measures, like supporting their observership at the World Health Agency, or Assembly rather, something that they were not allowed to do this past week.
I want to get to the political dynamic, though, in a moment. But first, want to get Mackenzie's take on that. I want to get to the political dynamic in a moment. But Mackenzie, first, I want to try to get your take on this as well, because I think one of the things that also may be irritating China is how much Americans are focused on reinforcing the relationship with Taiwan, and how Taiwan is trying to, and very, very astutely trying to take advantage of the moment, for example, by opening up a chip factory in the United States in Arizona, which is a dramatic step hey, you know, if you are worried about getting this capability from China, we as Taiwan, a fellow democracy, are willing to supply this to you. But, you know, give us your sense on some of the things that Patrick was saying.
There is a growing disconnect between what the Pentagon, how the Pentagon wants to maintain and reinforce the relationship with Taiwan and how politicians want that to be done. And I think the emphasis on economics and diplomacy and other aspects of, you know, tools of statecraft are the right ones, because the security link is the weakest here. So this is something the National Defense Strategy Commission really wrestled with behind the scenes. And, you know, as a staffer, you know, we're the fly on the wall, and you get to listen to these hundreds of conversations with allies and senior Pentagon officials and others. And in the report, there's a vignette that the commissioners put in there. So it's, you know, a potential future scenario not to be taken too seriously, but actually maybe kind of take it seriously, where the prospect of losing Taiwan in 3 years' time from today is seen as very, very possible, if not likely. And there's a reason they put that in there. So yes, I think Congress, members of Congress who emphasize particularly economic means of building that relationship, that's probably the best angle right now. But at some point we have to reconcile what's going on with DOD and their calculations regarding a potential surprise attack by China.
And I would just augment what Mackenzie's saying there. I think Mackenzie as well, you know, the Taipei Act, for instance, is about more diplomatic recognition and on top of the economic engagement that they're seeking. And there's a lot of talk, of course, about an Indo-Pacific deterrence initiative, where there could be additional ways to sort of shore up deterrence, although that may be about our deployment of conventional missiles, for instance, to the region more than other things.
But one of the questions which I have, and I know we've all discussed this, but a fundamental reality is that I think folks have a tremendous amount of respect for Matt Pottinger. I think folks even in the region really appreciate all the stuff that the Pentagon is doing by and large. There is a massive disagreement, as everybody knows, between Japan and South Korea and the U.S. demand for $5 billion from each of them for basing, which has gone over very, very badly. But the fundamental question is whether the President of the United States actually sees China as a threat, or maybe the line is somewhat less than that. And senior Japanese have said this to me, Koreans have said this to me, Australians have said this to me, that your president just cares about a trade deal. And the problem is that the Chinese know it, because the Chinese remind them, hey, by the way, Trump doesn't really care what we do in this region as long as he gets the trade deal we promised them. So how important is it that the president say the right things on a consistent basis? I mean, can you have this duality? Because at the end of the day, folks really aren't paying as much attention to what the Secretary of State is saying than they do what's coming out of the president.
Well, Bago, I'm not sure there's one thing that could be done to kind of streamline U.S. strategy and the clarity of our reliability and our strength of commitment to the region. I usually point to the fact that, as Michael Green writes in By More Than Providence, his excellent book on the 200 plus year history of our engagement with the region, overall, America has been consistently and increasingly engaged in trying to maintain a balance of power, open commerce, the open flow of ideas, and prevent harm from flowing from Asia to the United States. And that's been the consistent record. It's going to continue. But the uncertainty that comes about from leaning heavily on allies to do more, or even using tariffs against allies, not just against a competitive economy like China, sends mixed signals at best, as you suggest. So, of course, the United States can do much better at trying to separate what we're trying to do. And indeed, the document coming out of President Trump's White House today is all about allies and partners have to understand we're with them, but they're not consistently hearing that message. So I can't read the president's mind. I don't think he's just about economics, but clearly he is maybe mostly focused on the economic front and always has been. But regardless of what he is focused on, his administration is bigger than just one man, and they have to be willing and able to reassure allies sufficiently in Australia, Japan, Korea, and elsewhere around the world, but especially those big three key allies in Asia, that we are absolutely behind them, and we're going to work with them, even if we have to change burden sharing, just as President Nixon did after Vietnam, and just as other presidents have tried to do from time to time, to kind of realize a better burden sharing. It's a message that is tough to sell, but other presidents have done it, and this president and this administration still is learning how to do this, I think, more convincingly.
Mackenzie?
There's only one person that can put the mosaic together for the American people, and or one entity, I should say, and that's the White House. So, because, you know, if you talk to Pentagon leaders, they will give you a list of reasons why winning a long-term competition with China is the number one defense priority now. But, of course, they have to stay in their lane and focus on security issues only. But the White House needs to be increasingly savvy in using all those tools. So when China cuts off the Australian imports of its beef, what can we do then to step in and say, well, hey, we're going to negotiate a plan with X, Y, or Z country, if not our own, to be right there in the middle of it and give them some kind of backstop, you know, to ameliorate, excuse me, the fallout from that. The mosaic, though, is bigger. We talked about this on another podcast, so I don't want to get too repetitive, but obviously, you know, the Hong Kong democracy protests, but how it reached all the way down into Houston here and, you know, had an NBA coach take down his tweet after pressure from the Chinese government. It's their near takeover of Hollywood and all the scripts. It's the torture of Muslims, millions of them. It's the OPM hack and the stealing of Americans' data. It's the J-20 flying when our former Secretary of Defense visited China and basically said, you know, we don't need air superiority fighters anymore in the numbers we said we did. It's even the spy plane capture of the crew in the Bush administration. Did we forget about that and how they wouldn't let them go for weeks on end and re-engineered the airplane? So, I mean, there's not a comprehensive picture for Americans about all of the different ways that we need to compete. And the White House has to do that in addition to that great list that they've put out. Now they need to get the story right.
Let's go to the question of the two other big things that happened China-wise, I think in the last 24 hours, on arms control. On the one hand, the administration announced that it wants a new INF process, this one that would include China. Obviously, that was a big complaint that some folks in the White House had, that Russia was violating the INF treaty and China wasn't part of it. And then we have the United States saying that it's going to exit the Open Skies Treaty in 6 months, citing Russian violations of the 2002 treaty to foster greater openness, that nations, participating nations, can overfly somebody else's, another member's territory with very, very little notice, although the Russians have been putting some of its territory off limits to folks. Patrick, let's start with you, because I think you and I at the time did talk about this, and we agreed that it would be smart to try to get China to be part of the INF agreement, right? So dissolution of it was not necessarily a bad thing if you can get China to be in it. Why would China become party to this agreement? And is it possible to resuscitate it in a tripartite fashion between Washington, Beijing, and Moscow? And if so, how?
Well, clearly we're no longer in a U.S.-Soviet Cold War. And that was the situation when Eisenhower set up Open Skies. It made a lot of sense at the time to try to prevent the missile gap and accidental warfare. But with China looming large today, it's very important to find a framework for engaging China and a strategic framework that balances our security concerns. We haven't found that balance. We haven't found that framework. And China has been a reluctant partner. It does not want to be constrained before it gets stronger. It doesn't want to be constrained before it has a certain degree of military superiority or at least parity on the nuclear side and superiority maybe through other comprehensive means, including in cyber and outer space and elsewhere. And that's one reason why we've not been successful at convincing China that they ought to talk to us about limits on their buildup. They're still building up. And they like the trajectory, and they think we're a declining power. and cannot sustain it. So that's the real problem, Vago. It's not a matter of diplomacy just trying to convince Xi Jinping that, hey, let's sit down, we can all get along. But it may come to that. That is, there is enough concern about instability. China and the United States and Russia, for that matter, do share concerns about preventing a nuclear war, but they don't fear it. They don't fear it from us, and therefore they feel that they can take greater risk by, in Russia's case, saber-rattling. North Korea's case, by the way, unstinting buildup, trying to emulate Pakistan, and now China talking about 1,000 nuclear warheads potentially. A significant increase for the minimal nuclear deterrent they have declared in the past, and they're modernizing. They're creating the triad as well at the same time. So nuclear war isn't likely, but nuclear weapons seem to be happening. So the sky isn't falling, but it's becoming more overcast, you might say.
Well, this administration, I think, rightfully put nuclear modernization, a new generation of smaller warheads, to try to have a broader and more worrisome arsenal, given the breadth, for example, of the Russian and Chinese tactical arsenals. Mackenzie?
Yeah, I don't have much to add except to say that last point about broadening the arsenal to include smaller and different types of weapons, that's the most contentious proposal that the Pentagon has raised right now politically, as in that's where the two parties get diverged pretty quickly. And I could see that becoming in itself, you know, a somewhat nerdy, but potential election issue also. And it might be one of the first things to go if there's a new administration in town next year. And I'm sure the Chinese are watching that pretty closely.
Obviously this is going to be an election issue. We've already seen some ads where the president is trying to portray Joe Biden as weak on China. The Biden side has put an ad out showing using some of the president's very positive statements on Xi as a weapon against Trump. You know, instead of getting on how this is going to play politically, because I think that's an issue that we've discussed, there's a focus on how COVID-19 is going to affect U.S. defense spending and allied defense spending. But there isn't as much of a discussion on how that's going to affect Chinese spending, because ultimately there is going to be a Chinese financial impact here as well. Growth rates are declining for the first time in a long time. China needs those growth rates. Patrick, as you mentioned, the debt is now 300% of GDP, which is not good. How does this crisis affect China's ability to modernize at the pace that it's been modernizing?
Well, they also face serious questions about sustainability, and yet, for obvious political reasons, because Xi Jinping needs the military, he wants to flex muscle, he is actually indicating that he wants to increase the PLA's defense budget when it's been going down slightly over the last few years. And that would be obviously a political override of an economic reality. So it's not clear that they can sustain that, but the signal that Xi Jinping wants to send right now in May of 2020 is that he's going to increase defense, he's going to get tough on Hong Kong, tough on Taiwan, tough on the South China Sea, tougher on nuclear war. You know, he is the guy who's going to take on Trump on cyber, on high technology. And that's the card he's playing, just as President Trump and Joe Biden seem to be playing their own China rivalry politics here at home.
Mackenzie?
Meanwhile, this week...
Meanwhile, back at the ranch.
Right. There were almost 29, almost 30 Democrats in the House who wrote a letter to the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, basically saying you need to cut the defense budget because of the pandemic. And, well, that's not a huge number. It certainly could put the bill at risk if there was a repeat of last year's vote, where it originally came out of the House on party line, originally passed the House on party line votes strictly. Chairman Smith said he learned his lesson. He's not going to make it so partisan this year. I mean, you know, so that's a tough job that he's got. But it's an interesting letter because it represents a couple of themes in Washington that are opposite of the ones that we just described China. So in the middle of the emergency, you know, some members of Congress are already trying to identify bill payers. That's pretty unusual. And it's actually not even required, because this is considered emergency money, as in we're borrowing it. We're not counting it against revenues collected and taxes this year, et cetera. So, it's something to worry about eventually, but it's not immediate concern. The immediate concern should be, sort of getting the health of the citizenry secured and the economy back on track. And it's a little oddly timed. And I think that's a big warning sign for the Pentagon leadership, who's already behind the eight ball in terms of not being able to afford its own strategy. And what are they going to do to reconcile that as in terms of the number that they say they need and what they're actually getting this year, but really next year and the year after. So I think it reflects the more members than signed the letter. Also that, the president's gone around saying the military's rebuilt or close to rebuilt or completely. He's used different terms in different weeks. And so if the job's done, then, we do need to prop up other organizations that are, what to prepare for the next pandemic and to spend more money socially on issues here like healthcare and our medical system, which clearly has shown some gaps because of COVID-19. So that is quite different than the trajectory in not just defense top lines, but purchasing power. It's a worrisome trend.
Well, but I mean, if you look back at the 2008 financial crisis, we found a lot of Republicans who didn't want to vote for it, right? Concerned about debt, and we just shouldn't be bailing people out. We shouldn't be bailing individuals out. We shouldn't be bailing businesses out. And at the end of the day, there are even Republican friends of mine who raised the issue of why does defense spending need to be so massive when it's not abundantly clear how national security is helping me solve the COVID-19 problem. I'm not necessarily sure that's the right way to look at it. You have those military forces for a variety of other reasons than once in a century pandemic that hits you. Right. I mean, even if the capability the military is not providing may be as relevant, it doesn't mean that investment is not valuable.
Of course.
Patrick, let me just bring you into this just for 1 second. How are these debates perceived in China at a time when the Chinese are trying to portray strength, but also try to assess where we're going? Just very briefly, where do you see, how is this messaging received on Beijing's part? And then Mackenzie, have a quick follow-up and then we can part for the week.
I think in short, while there is criticism of Xi Jinping that has grown since the pandemic in particular, there is very little support for U.S. hardline policies aimed at competing with China. So maybe not surprisingly, but the line is hardened in China, and there's no reason to sort of promote an anti-U.S., anything but an anti-U.S. line in China these days. So if they do support us, they're being very quiet about it. And they're, in fact, probably go along happily with things like the crackdown on Hong Kong.
The other question, though, was when U.S. lawmakers are calling on reductions in defense spending, what sort of messaging does that send? Because I find that the Chinese spend quite a lot of time to understand what's, quote unquote, really going on in Washington. How do they perceive things like this, that, hey, the defense budget should be cut? We can't, have a bigger debt. We've got to tighten our belts.
Well, they both read McKinsey's analysis and the analysis of others like Todd Harrison, and they know that there are real challenges for the defense budget in the United States. And so when they hear members of Congress say there are problems with the defense spending, they think that's right. It also comports with their own propaganda, which sees us as a declining power.
Right.
So unfortunately, it's just playing right into their own preconceived notions.
And Mackenzie, you mentioned the budgetary picture. So you got to my question before I was going to ask it. But is there any other update you can give us on how the budget is percolating along and next stimulus package and what next stimulus package means potentially for defense spending and whether you've adjusted your outlook for where we end up this year and next? Because the sense is, the problem is more of a next year problem, but it is also possible it may manifest itself this year as well.
That's right. I am seeing it as a potentially positive sign that some Republicans are pressuring the Senate Majority Leader, a fellow Republican, that no, actually more stimulus is needed. Senator McConnell has long been a fiscal hawk. He's given floor speech after floor speech about needing to rein in the debt long before this pandemic. And this is a cause near and dear to his heart. He has basically said, you know, I'm not sure we're even going to need any further stimulus. Let's just wait and see as states reopen. But other Republican senators are increasingly telling him publicly and privately, actually, I think, you know, can you please reconsider that? And so that's actually a good sign, because I do, as I've said before, there is more stimulus needed, particularly for the defense industrial base, to support jobs. Even though that's not the purpose of the defense budget, in this case, you do need that workforce to come back and keep building what they said they were going to build and create for DOD before there was COVID-19. So that's a new development from this week.
Mackenzie, Patrick, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Hope you and yours and your teams stay well, and you guys have a great Memorial Day weekend. Thanks again.
Thank you, Vargo. You too.
Thanks again.
And thanks for joining us. Please follow our daily interviews with top government, military, industry, and thought leaders at Defense and Aerospace Report, and subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter at Def Aero Report. That's at DefAero Report. Like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And check out our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. For more than 80 years, Bell has pushed past the boundaries of what's possible to drive aviation forward, going above and beyond flight, bellflight.com. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.